Today's topic is about breaking free. And I got started on this idea the other day when I was thinking about my need for and my desire to feel more trusting. We learn to be untrusting and probably learn how to be untrustworthy early on. And even though these attitudes and behaviors don't serve us, we practice them over and over until they become habits. When habits control our lives, we are not free. Now, the word breaking says we're fighting against something. And usually I say this is not a good idea because we feed what we fight. Look at the wars in the U.S., cancer, drugs, and on and on and on. We recognize that as we fight something, we're adding energy to it. We're actually strengthening it, enlarging it, and make it even more problematic. But in this context, I want to say that breaking free is a reference to an act of will. That's an important concept, act of will, that directionalizes our energy. So I'll say our energy is our attention, our intention, any other energies that we may have. And we directionalize those to change and to go through a restrictive barrier. Think of this like a chick that is breaking free from its shell. At one point, that shell was protective. And then over time, depending on the level of growth of that chick, at some point, that shell becomes a prison. And if that chick doesn't break free of it, it is going to be deprived of a full, healthy life. Could end in being stunted. Its growth could be stunted to the point and extreme of it could die unless it breaks free from that imprisoning shell. When you think of a habit is kind of like a computer program or today's lingo, like an app. An app that controls our thinking, feeling, speaking, and our acting. So we learn these behaviors and we convert them into habits because we practice them over and over again. And the reason for habits, they're good things by and large, and they're designed to save us time, help us be more efficient, save us energy, and so on. And because they're so automatic, we don't have to think so much or pay so much attention during those activities. Think about driving a car, for instance. Every single activity involved in that process of driving a car, if you had to think about it each time anew, would take a lot more energy. A lot of that stuff is almost on remote control. We do it like a robot. And a problem with a habit is that they tend to exclude new information. Right? We go into that automatic pilot thing, and then the habits do what they're supposed to do, as if they're following a strict instruction or a recipe. It doesn't allow for additional information to penetrate. When it comes down to it, a lot of our thoughts, you know, the thoughts that we claim are ours, oh yeah, that's my thought, oh, those are my feelings, those are my words, those are my actions, but they're not really ours. They are habits running us. Our beliefs are not really ours. They were given to us by others or by ourselves through our computations, our calculations, our interpretations, and our conclusions. And as a result of all of that, we say they're our beliefs. If we have a habit running us, we don't actually do much thinking about that activity. Considering what we know about God, and this is a classic example, a lot of what we know about God actually was delivered to us. It was delivered to us when we were little children in, Sunday school type environments, either at home or in schools or in churches. And so that information is delivered to us. And if that child and their parents indicate to them that's all there is, you don't need to know any more, you just got information that was suitable for a 5 or a 6 year old, that's the end of story, you don't need any more information, then reaching out over a person's lifetime, looking for more information, greater understanding of the nature of God and our relationship with it, is not even going to be considered. It's like, no. When I was 6, I got all the information there is to know about this thing called God. The habit of considering God to be one way prevents any possible growth in our awareness of God. And you can hear this when you talk to people. And their habits of thinking about life, thinking about themselves, thinking about others, thinking about the activities of life, are so rigid, so conclusive, that they preclude new information from penetrating the human consciousness. The idea that we allow habits to run our lives and our feelings and our thoughts and actions says, and our words, says it's kind of like turning around and giving a small child control of the steering wheel in a vehicle that's moving at a rapid pace, moving down the highway at a high speed. And when we think of these habits, we say, oh, yeah. You know what? I obey these habits that are triggered by our body's yearning for certain types of food, sugar or drugs or the one thing, comfort foods, and on and on and on. When we give into those yearnings because we've habitualized them, then now what we're really doing is relinquishing management responsibility over a lot of processes that originally were created by irresponsibility. When we do something for the very first time, it's as if we're running a new program, or at least attempting it. We're breaking brush. Breaking brush is a military slang for making a path through an area of jungle or forest or brush or vegetation where no one has gone before. And if we repeat that activity many times, the path now that we've broken through becomes well-worn. If we repeat a mental or emotional or a physical activity many times, it becomes a habit. We could say a habit is a well-worn behavior because we have practiced it many times. We could say that a habit is a path which makes an activity easier to do because by repetition we break down the resistance. So that first time going through brush is you're bumping into trees and bushes and briars and other things, and over time those resistances, those obstacles, those barriers get removed. While a habit makes a behavior easier to repeat, in comparison, it makes new behaviors, new contrary behaviors, much more difficult to do. Comparing the ease of the current behavior of something that we've been doing over and over again to what we then project and expect to be difficulty of breaking brush, doing a new activity, overcoming this, that's hard, oh, there's a lot of resistance. It makes breaking free of a habit a daunting task. What started as a reasonable desire to make an activity support our, and any person does this, support our getting our needs met, ends up becoming like that shell or some other container that now prevents us or limits us from expressing our energy in different directions. No, it's easier to do it this way. Yeah, but that doesn't really get you to where you want to go. I know, but it's easier to do it this way because I've habitualized it. Exactly. Habits, tools of convenience and efficiency, initially, turn into prison cells. They don't let us out. They make us conform to them. They control us. We don't control them. Now, if we imagine habits kind of like energetic paths or energetic fences or as energetic suits of robotic behavior, we can begin to notice how completely we may have consigned our power over to our habits. If you've ever seen anybody standing outside in the cold weather alongside of a building, now that smoking inside of a building is against the law, so totally socially unacceptable, standing out in the cold, shivering, smoking a cigarette. And if you ask them why, is it because they like to smoke. We make up all kinds of excuses and justification for the way we behave. I like to be out here. I don't think so. It's occurred to me that one of the worst personal habits, if not the worst, is unforgiveness. Unforgiveness of self, which then is projected outward, ripples outward into unforgiveness of others. Breaking free of unforgiveness is life-changing. You know, if we were to look at a timeline of our life as a one dimension, right, of the, what I refer to as the path. So you draw a horizontal line, and it could be straight, although that's not exactly how it would be, of course. We've got ups and downs and zigs and zags and backs and forth. So, but for drawing purposes, maybe a straight line works. So starting from, say, conception, the moment of conception, till 120, now we can start to populate that idea. We could populate the timeline with our goals. What are our goals? We could say that those are the milestones, or those are the destinations. That's what we wanted to achieve along the way. So a goal for a 5-year-old is certainly different than the goal for a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 40-year-old. And you would go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I could, at the age 5, I could put out a goal, maybe a little bit into the future of that, where I wanted a new bike or a new baseball glove or something of that sort. And then all of a sudden we could start to see where there were events that occurred on that timeline, events when we were disappointed, where we didn't do something for somebody else that we could have done, and that would be considered self-betrayal in some schools of thought, which I think is a valid concept. And we could look on that and say, oh, okay, well, I need to be forgiven for what I did and didn't do here and there and there and there. And, okay, hold on, let me populate this line with something else. This is where I need to forgive other people for what they did or didn't do, and here and here and here and there and there. And then you say, you know what? When I look at the things that I would like to forgive myself for and others for, I pretty much can conclude that those things were expression of a human ego. That human ego, if we could understand what that is, that what's driving us for comfort and to have what we want at the expense of others without regard to others, and a lot of different ways of it manifesting, if we could identify how that ego plays out in us and other people, we would go, oh yeah, yeah, I can see this, yeah. And then it becomes easier, in my opinion, to release those behaviors instead of holding on to them in guilt or holding on to them in unforgiveness, either of ourselves or of other people. So if you could understand how the ego expresses itself in a negative way, then it becomes easier to recognize, okay, I see that behavior in the past on my timeline, but I also see that as a habit pattern, and now I know when that urge to express my ego comes up, I'm in a position to be able to make a different choice. Studying the book Christ Returns reveals startling truth to understand the ego and its power and its influence over us would be a great place to start. Christ does a fantastic job of bringing that into perspective of how that ego drives so many behaviors that ultimately end up in our suffering and the suffering of others, in illness, unhappiness, and lack of success, lack of harmony, lack of love. Perceiving threats is a habit. It's a damaging one. Right now in Florida, there's a lot of talk on television and elsewhere about hurricanes and tropical storms. Right now, in the appears to be the near future, as in later today, Tropical Storm Isaac is going to make landfall in southwest Florida where we live. And so there's a lot of drama, a lot of fear, a lot of all of that stuff producing threat levels. So they've got likely and possible and imminent and all kinds of different color coding and so on going on. A lot of people are glued to the Weather Channel and maybe other news programs looking for information about this threat. In today's airport security situation, for example, where it's all about threat, right? TSA is there, the threat is orange as you drive into an airport, and they have all kinds of announcements about security and threats and so on. And those threat levels are identified by colors, right? And that in the first glance, you could say, oh, a color, what does that represent? I say it represents time. Just imagine that. The amount of time between now and a likely attack, in the opinion of whoever's controlling the colors, would give us a clue of what's going on. For instance, the yellow alert would mean something like, we perceive that there's a lot of time between now and an attack. So, don't come out of fight or flight, but just recognize the timing is a little bit different, a little bit longer than, let's say, orange. Orange means that, the amount of time between now and an attack is less than if it were yellow, but not as short as if it were red. You go, still fairly soon, the attack could come fairly soon. And then the red alert would mean that time is pretty much elapsed. The attack, the danger, the threat is nearly here. It's now. It's soon to arrive. So that's time in terms of threat. Another way to perceive threat levels, and these are marketed, is to use distance or space as a way to judge it. So looking at Weather Channel, which my wife insists upon doing, despite me, is to be able to look at it and go, okay, the storm is in off the coast of Haiti and Dominican Republic. Okay, now it's Cuba. Okay, now it's near Key West. Okay, now it's near us. So we look at it in the terms of space or distance. The Vietnam War was fought under the pretext that the threat of communist expansion in Southeast Asia was a direct threat to the United States security, even though Vietnam is on the other side of the world. So somebody who decided it was a threat, but, that distance of half a world is really, really short. We've got to... And then they constructed the context for that. They faked the Pueblo attack. They used that as a triggering event, and off we went into war. When the 9/11 attacks occurred, it became clear to Americans for the very first time that the distance of the threat from us now had been reduced to zero. No longer were the threats still in faraway lands, in the Middle East or in Africa or South America or in Asia, but in fact, the threats had come to us. If we drew pictures of ourselves, and I'm a stick figure kind of artist, and surround ourselves with a set of concentric circles, we could choose to label those circles as threat levels. They could be considered time, or we could consider them space or distance. But if we further realize that actually what we're doing is populating those circles with the content of our thoughts, our feelings, our words, and our actions, then drawing the other vibrations and putting them in there, worrying about Iran, worrying about this, worrying about terrorists, worrying about global warming, worrying about foreclosure, worrying about, we're adding the vibration of those threats that we're perceiving into those circles, and then we draw them to us. If we understood that, we'd be like, you know what? I'd like to make other choices. I don't want to draw those to me. I want to make other choices. But you can think of it like this. A person driving dangerously in a car, right, driving 90 miles an hour or swerving in. Recently, we just came back from a car trip, and I saw a lot of different driving behaviors. Some head-scratching. We started to make a list of them. And doing other things that are dangerous activities, you could say that that person is not accurately perceiving the time or space considerations and consequences of those behaviors. You know, when there is like a half a car length and somebody pulls in without signaling into that space, causing people to slam on their brakes, you go, they didn't see space the way I was seeing space. If we're not seeing the dangers or the consequences of our behaviors, we're missing something. I don't think we need to exaggerate them. I don't think we need to invent them. But a person who doesn't study to learn in school, or a person who doesn't work diligently, or someone who doesn't recognize that they are sowing the seeds of the future life that they're going to be harvesting, are people who are not understanding the threat levels. They're not understanding how their lives are being created by their behaviors, by their thoughts, their feelings, their words, their actions. Besides using time and space as a way to measure or identify threat levels, I think we could also look at it in terms of matter and energy. If you've heard any of these recordings before, you would have heard me talk about the management of matter, management of energy, the management of space, and the management of time. Matter, energy, space, and time is what life is really about. That's what we're trying to do. We're managing this to try to produce desirable results for ourselves, our families, and ideally, we think in more globally than that, and include other people in it. We could say that if we can't manage matter, energy, space, and time, and we perceive we can't, we can, but if we perceive that we can't manage matter, energy, space, and time, then what's going to happen to us is we're going to produce an enormous amount of stress in our own bodies, probably those people around us, and we're going to start perceiving threats where there were none before. In today's political environment, this is a stress-inducing process, if there ever was one. There are certain topics that get pushed up the scale of importances and urgencies so as to control the conversations. Things like pro-choice rights, the budget, health care for women and families can be considered to be the energy that we try to manage. There are many other topics that could fall into this category. We could also say that the bullets and criminals and immigrants and unemployed and the actual delivery of health care and so on are matter. Bridges, roads, parks are other examples of matter that need management. Now, depending on your situation and your consciousness, the elevation of the budget ahead of health care for women and children and ahead of home foreclosures may seem like a valid concept, or it may seem completely foolish. You could see the condition of the U.S. budget as the biggest threat to the country's survival, or you could see it as a smaller issue facing the country. What seems to be overlooked on all kinds of levels, at the highest political levels, on business levels, on personal levels, is that we reap what we sow. If we sow bombs and bullets, we can expect to reap bombs and bullets. If we reduce people's freedoms, we can expect to have our freedom reduced. For some people, in some countries in the world, America is the threat. We are the saber-toothed tiger, and we're that saber-toothed tiger that they're perceiving is largely powered by our most avaricious corporations and by the military-industrial complex looking to create war. And so we have politicians who are either trying to rein in this aggressive behavior, or they're fanning it with the intention of profiting and benefiting from it, getting reelected again. Profiting from war, death, and destruction is really what drives this human activity. There's a tendency for some people to claim, oh, we got to protect you from fill in the blank, a lot of different things. And in the process, they have to reduce our freedom, but it's designed to protect us. That's why they're doing it. As we focus on threats, real or imagined, we send our bodies into self-protect mode. In this state, we disadvantage ourselves. We're less cognitive, we're more reactive. We're very easy to influence and control. This is the same method used with herding cattle or sheep. It's done deliberately. When people promote one form of enemy over another, or one form of threat over another, they're usually doing it for their own benefit. They may say it's for our good, it's in our self-interest, or it's for the good of the country, or other noble-sounding causes. While we tend to see physical threats as most easily, we can also feel emotional threats, threats to our beliefs and ways of thinking and being, are what seem to be at the root of some of the most savage human behavior. Talk of religion and politics, sends a lot of people, a lot of sane people. A minute ago, that person was sane. Now, all of a sudden, they're insane because the conversation threatened their beliefs about religion and politics. I want to propose another definition of a threat. In this definition, a threat is anyone or anything that induces us to offer a lower vibration to the object of our attention. It induces us, but we're not like a piece of metal, like having electricity induced in a piece of metal through electromagnetism. We can make a choice. It's our responsibility. A lot of people say, no, that's not really a good threat definition. I got a better one. It's anything that impedes me getting what I want when I want it. Now, a little child would choose that as a definition of a threat. And then maybe there's another one that says, anything that is contrary to my I-ness, I-ness, N-E-S-S, my individuality, my sense of identity, who and what I am, anything that threatens that structure is what I would consider a threat. Okay, that's cool. But maybe, if we could understand how we create the sense of individuality, this identity that we are walking around encased in, maybe we were like, wait a minute, this is not the structure that I want. This is too defensive, it's too angry, it's too fearful, it's too restrictive, it's too imprisoning. Then maybe we could debug it. Maybe we could notice that it's generating tremendous numbers of negative thoughts and feelings, words and actions. And if we could change it, if we could heal it, we'd be much better off. We could break free. If our I-ness is constructed of experiences and beliefs of not enoughness, not enough, not tall enough, rich enough, smart enough, thin enough, fat enough, big enough, strong, on and on. And you add in unpredictability that we would have experienced in our lives from conception till right now, and the criticism and the attacks, verbal and otherwise, or the fear of those kind of attacks, we're going to be much more sensitive to threats. That is why we want to heal this area, this structure of us. Here are a couple of critical questions that would serve us to answer. How is my I-ness, my identity, my individuality created? How are these created? Not only me, but other people too, because we're going to engage with other people all day long, every day. The second question, how can we modify, improve, or heal our I-ness, our individuality, our sense of identity? How can we heal that? If we live as though we are our I-ness, the structure, the structure is me, then we recognize that we're going to be bumping into walls. But if we're continually growing our awareness of our identity, then we've got a chance. We could recognize that we can create a more effective identity, and that would be a fantastic goal. The other main goal we might want to have would be to discover who and what we are above and beyond this sense of individuality that we've developed in physical form. Then we would be free. One of my favorite books prior to Christ's Returns Reveal Startling Truth was the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus the Christ. It's a little over 100 years old as a book. And in chapter 92, Jesus says this to a group of people he's with. There are two sturdy S's that bind the will of man. They are called fear and unbelief. When they are caught and turned aside, the will of man will know no bounds. He will have but to speak, and it will be done. Our habits are largely controlled by fear. Those that are not really serve us. Those that are fear-driven don't serve us. They are in control. For us to realize that, recognize that, get a fuller understanding of it, and make other choices, use an active will to break free of those two sturdy asses, will result in us breaking free. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.